Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another episode for Beyond the Mekong. And with me today is the military analyst Paul Greening, who has featured on this podcast quite a few times before. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Luke. It's very nice to talk to you again.
Now, you're based up in May Site along the border area with Myanmar. You've given us quite a few updates over the past year or so with what's happening inside Myanmar, in particular the civil war. Scam compounds, human trafficking, the Chinese criminal syndicates have burst back into the headlines with the Thais initiating an extraordinary crackdown with the backing of the Chinese. Can you bring us up to date, please, with what's been happening up there?
Okay, well, just a very, very brief background. COVID-19 pandemic, at that time you had the casinos in the Mayawady area, they shifted more to online because of necessity and became more high-tech and more lucrative. Now they're worth billions of dollars. In 2020, there was a lot of Chinese in May Sot, ostensibly for quarantine, ready to go over to Sue Coco, one of the biggest compounds. Apparently, in May Sot, someone was telling me the other night, they were spending most of their time looking for young girls and taking over kitchens to cook Chinese food.
Oh, God.
Then there was a crackdown in 2022 on cyber scam centers, as you very well know, in Cambodia, in Sinopil. They then moved to, as they tend to, moved and adapted, moved to the Myanmar-Chinese border. A rebel offensive by the Free Brotherhood Alliance. The offensive was called 1027. 27th of October, that cleared them out. That was in 2023. Then, of course, they moved to the Mayawady area. They say in Myanmar now there's about 200,000 individuals involved in the scamming across Myanmar, and 60% of those are Chinese. One thing important to mention, and it's not mentioned enough, is not all of these people that are working in the scam centers are victims. Besides the bosses, the big Chinese mafia, the Yai Tai, and the various and border guard force and the DKPA working with them, etc., you also have people who are just going there, knowing the job they will be doing to make money. One example was a Russian scammer, who I thought was a victim. I supported him a little bit one evening, and then I asked him what his story was. Apparently, he was in Cambodia. Sinopville, I believe, and he had a nice job, he was making money in a scam compound. Then that closed, or was closed, rather. He moved to Bangkok for a couple of months, and after that, he applied for a job in KK Park, got a job in KK Park, but after a few months, he didn't really like that. I asked if he was tortured, suffered, you know, any bad treatment. He said no, but my boss was angry at me because I wasn't getting the right results.
Right.
So then he moved on. He's now looking for somewhere else. So you have those people as well, and it's estimated that it could be 90 to 95% that were actually going there, knowing that what the sort of work they'll be doing, but still going there and maybe not liking it. And how do they get out when they have, you know, they've got no Myanmar visa, their Thai visa has expired. Obvious way is to say they were trafficked. So
screening
them is a big issue there.
I doubt it's 90%, but...
Sorry, Luke, I missed that.
So I doubt it's 90% of the people went there willingly, but I think it is a very big issue that the Thais and the Chinese in particular are confronting in trying to determine who are the victims and who went willingly. And... you know, who are the big-time players in there making lots of money and writing apps for scamming?
Well, Luke, I got the information that from one person that used to live in the compounds, getting people out, and has done that for years, and his estimate was actually 95% are actually there voluntarily. They might not like it later, they might not get the money they expected, they might not be treated well there, but they went there knowing that they'd be scamming people. This is, anyway, I can't verify that. No one can, but this is the figures that I've got.
Yep.
And of course, the bigger people have got out. They've got golden passports. They've gone to Yangon, wherever. They've got out. They will never be prosecuted. I think about six of them are being given up.
This is the, we're talking about the people who have been running the scam compounds over the last couple of years. Now, the Thais have initiated a crackdown, and they're starting to flee. Is that correct? And they're heading into Yangon, and as you mentioned, the golden passports, they can pretty much go where they want.
Exactly. So the big bosses also know too much to be actually prosecuted. They know too much about probably people in the Thai authorities and also people, the Karen militia groups. They probably know too much to be allowed out anyway. So the likelihood of them actually being arrested is remote.
Right. And you're talking, of course, about the various players who have been, who controls the scam compounds? It's said it's the Border Security Guard Forces, which is a militia of the military junta that kicked off the civil war a few years back by ousting the government. Then there's the splinter groups in the Karen militia. Would that be the right way of putting it?
It was split off from BGF, the Border Guard Force, the DKBA.
Okay. But they've been accused of running the compounds, or at least enabling the criminal syndicates to thrive over the last couple of years. Is that correct?
Yes, they deny that. BGF now, under threat of possible arrest warrants, is saying they're collecting the scammers, they're handing them over. They're saying that all they did was rented the land and they didn't know what was happening.
Right.
So this is the line at the moment.
I've heard that in Cambodia a few times.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So what have the Thais actually done to make life difficult for these syndicates, in that they trade in Myanmar right on the border? That way they can access Thai electricity, internet connections. Maesot's a pretty big town. You can get everything you need there. It's a short hop over the Mui River. So they've been able to operate under, the cloak of the civil war makes that region pretty much lawless. And so they've been able to do whatever they want, but at the same time, it makes it difficult for the Thais or anybody else to cross over and do anything about it, because it's another country. It's sovereign rules.
Yes, the Thais were not really doing much about it, to be honest, until the small-time Chinese actor called Wang Zi.
Yep.
He was apparently trafficked, and his girlfriend put it out on social media in China. It went viral, and it affected Chinese tourism, which, of course, is big money for Thailand. So that upset them a lot. The victims' families were calling on the Chinese government all the time, putting pressure on the Chinese government. And also, I think the Chinese state started seeing that these scam centers were becoming a bit big and a bit of a threat to them as well. So I think China wanted to get rid of them for that reason. Also, one thing very interestingly, from the Chinese point of view, this has given them the opportunity of putting a security presence in Thailand, which they wanted to do for a long time, but they haven't been able to. Now they have done that. So there's local security influence. They're setting a permanent office up in Maesot.
From their point of view,
it's going to be extremely useful.
Is this part to do with boots on grounds in Myanmar, the joint security company they wanted to establish to protect their oil and gas pipeline?
This is basically more of a surveillance information gathering unit.
Right.
Will be based in Maesot.
Okay.
So it's spreading their sort of security influence from Thailand, because of the pressure from China. They had no choice, so they cut off electricity and fuel.
Yeah.
To the 36 odd scam compounds in five sort of different areas. They cut that off because, of course, it had come over from Thailand. They didn't construct some material, and I went along the border, and there's some construction companies with, knee-deep. So that continued. The scam compounds started getting generators in, more expensive, but they're multi-billion-dollar industry, so they can actually afford that. In the north, they got electricity from Laos, which the Thais are trying to cut off as well. So they've actually injured them and hurt them. When you think of it, it's 200,000 scammers. The most they're going to get out, and it's going slowly at the moment, is about 10,000. Small number.
Yeah, I was struggling to reconcile the numbers. The rest of the world's media jumped on this story and talking about the issue as if they understand it. And they're, the holes in their stories all over the place, and everybody's screaming what a terrific number. 10,000 people. And the UN report in mid-23, it's 2 years old now. I mean, that was 120,000 in Myanmar. And I think, as you were saying, at the moment, they think there's 200,000. So 10,000 doesn't sound like a lot.
It isn't. And the 200,000 is confirmed by Jason Tower in OSIP. Yep. And he's, a couple of days ago, he did an article, I think it was in Irrawaddy, that came out. So yep. You know, it's been confirmed by him as well, not just my estimate.
Yep, Jason, of course, is with the United States Institute of Peace and has been following this issue quite closely. I'm just adding that in for the audience. Yep, sorry, mate, yep.
Yeah, no, exactly. So basically, Thailand hopefully will pacify China. It yep. will mean that the tourism will not be reduced. The Chinese tourists mm-hmm. will not be reduced. And they're going up to some record numbers. They were cancelling, but now that's getting out as well. The Chinese Assistant Minister for Public Security, Liu Songji, he was in Meisot, he went backwards and forwards across the border, and he's now in Cambodia, sorting out stuff there as well. So for him, it's like a success. It's a success.
Right.
He's getting lots of Chinese out. They've got a lot of information from the Chinese. They've got all the mobile phones. The Thais haven't to process them. They get them straight out on planes. China Southern Airlines, I think, straight off to China,
right,
where they will be interrogated and they'll have all the information they want. So it's everyone, I think, what I think will probably mm-hmm. happen is in a few weeks, people say, yes, great success. We've got them all out. We've got the horror stories of the victims.
Yeah.
And move on. But I don't think there's going to be an awful lot of change in the scam centers. Change that may happen mm-hmm. is they're going to be perhaps targeting more Americans than Chinese.
Right.
I've heard that they're more likely to target Americans. Also, rather than bring Chinese in,
yep.
which I'm sure they still will, they've got the Burmese-speaking Chinese on the border, the Kokang, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They're bringing them down. I've heard they've already got 20,000 of them in the scam centres in Meerwaddy. They're bringing them down. They're Myanmar citizens. It's a different issue. Not so easy to target them. So, as always, they're adapting and being flexible. But I don't think a multi-billion-dollar business like that is going to disappear anytime soon.
I think you're right. The Chinese do want to crack down on it. And last week, they sentenced 4 gangsters to life imprisonment for running scam compounds across the border. And the charges were interesting. One of them was procuring young boys to work in these compounds. And then there was quite a few of them also had previous criminal records. So the Chinese government, I think, are after the snakeheads. I think that's what they used to call the smugglers. But it's in that sense, I think it's working for them.
And that will play into the Chinese public very well. It will pacify the potential tourists to Thailand.
Right.
And China will end up with a greater security influence in this region. Well.
Which is what they want.
But that is one thing that's not been mentioned much.
Yep.
That it's got very little mention at all about that.
Well, that's why I was curious about it. You know, we had that story a few months back about the joint security company being established between the Myanmar military and Chinese, which could result in boots on ground to protect their oil and gas pipelines. And it's, that's not related to the current crackdown, but that's one. We're still waiting to hear what's happening on that front. And we'll go there in a minute, but what's happening in Rakhine, where the pipeline runs through, and what the Arakan army are up to around Sitwe is damn interesting. That's one issue. And now on the border, Meerwaddy and Meisot, they're establishing another presence.
Exactly. And also, if they can encourage in some way or have incentives for the syndicates to target Americans, that would be in China's interest as well.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese get the information from the scammers after interrogating them and checking their phones, etc. They don't share this information.
Mm-hmm.
This could be very interesting or useful information for the US law enforcement, but they don't share it with them. That is another issue.
We were talking about this earlier in the year, just before Trump took office. And, I don't know. If you had scammers targeting Americans and if Donald Trump wanted to retaliate, does the region really need the Americans back in here using Myanmar as some kind of proxy against China if they decided to get nasty with, you know, the DEA, the US feds?
That's a question because Thailand, of course, is under traditionally has been under more American influence.
Right.
If it sees it's losing that influence, they might be worried about that.
Well, that was
another thing I've heard is there's Westerners there's white people working in the scam centres doing more sophisticated work,
right,
like coding for apps for scamming. And I've actually heard from two sources, no confirmation, as I say, I can't verify, that some of those are American. There's about 200 of them at least.
Right, that's what I was going to ask.
This,
how many of them?
This could actually influence America as well to get more involved. Whether they do get involved or not, it could be a two-sided sword. Yeah, we don't know. It's a bit, it's going to be quite erratic with Trump. Right. We don't really know.
Regards
it might
to,
not be a possible thing.
Regards to 200 Caucasians, what countries are they from? You mentioned America. Were there any other nations that we should be aware of, particularly Western countries?
Western countries, I didn't hear of any others. Someone just said they'd seen a lot of them,
right,
and they were white. Caucasian.
Okay. Going back to what...
But this is, again, not verified, but I've heard it from two good sources, so it seems quite likely.
One would imagine that they would be the types of people that would go there willingly for the very big bucks, high-tech experience writing apps and that, all that sort of stuff that you need to steal money from people, really. But going back to what you were saying before about Thailand and America as allies, you have a new Secretary of State in Marco Rubio who used his confirmation ceremony to say he would stop Thailand from deporting the 48 Uyghurs that have been languishing in a detention centre in Bangkok for the last 10 years. And the Chinese have been pressuring Thailand to return them. And after all the bellowing by panels of UN experts and the NGOs and Western governments, Thailand deported them at China's behest on Thursday morning, tried to sneak them out under the cover of darkness at like 2 o'clock in the morning in a 4:30 a.m. flight. There have been a few allegations that the Thais had deliberately done this using the crackdown with the Chinese along its borders as a disguise.
Yeah, I think this could backfire badly on Thailand.
Right.
Very badly. The Uyghurs, years ago, Turkey offered to take them.
Yep.
I believe it's 40 Uyghurs that were deported, 8 were kept for criminal charges. If you look back to what happened in 2015, where General Paiute, as the leader of Thailand, he deported Uyghurs. They were trying to reach Turkey. And the Thai embassy in Ankara, Turkey, was attacked, which put 1,300 Thais at risk. More severely, you had the bombing in August 2015 of Erawan Shrine in the center of Bangkok that killed more than 20 people, Thais and foreigners. The suspect was a Uyghur, and this was presumed, no great analysis needed, to be a retaliation for the deportation. So now, if you look at the potential consequences, Thais abroad could be targeted in violent attacks. Thais in Thailand could face security risks. Thailand has lost some bargaining in trade talks with the US.
Right.
And, of course, Thailand is part of the UN Human Rights Commission.
Yeah.
And they criticise them quite strongly. So it's not really done Thailand any great favours in that way. Maybe they appeased China, but I think they could have caused a lot of trouble for themselves. America and the UK both put out warnings to their people to stay away from crowds, especially crowds like Chinese. And the Chinese, of course, like to go to some of the shrines, especially Erawan Shrine. So, you know, people are worried about this. They know this is a big issue. So I'm not sure if this was a particularly wise decision to make, even in real politic terms, as if you take out the human rights element.
Right. Tend to agree with much of what you just said. Back across the border, what is happening in Sitwe, which is the capital of Rakhine State and is basically the last holdout on the west for the military? Also, I guess, Mandalay, which has been laid siege by opposition. I know you don't like the word rebel, so I know it's been laid siege to by revolutionaries. So let's start with Rakhine. What's happening over there?
Well, Rakhine, the battle for the main town, Sitwe, has started.
Right.
Has started. Interestingly, AA has been using howitzer to some extent, which they took and captured from the Myanmar military. Also, you've got the battle for Chopio, where you have the oil and gas pipeline, etc., which has a big interest for China. So you've got that battle going on. it's very, very likely that the AA will take that, take both of those. You've got about 8 battalions, I believe, of the Myanmar military plus police in Sitwe. It could be a long battle. It could be quite a bloody battle.
Mm-hmm.
The Myanmar military has brought in human shields. For a while, they've been bringing in Rohingya from villages in the nearby area. They brought them in. Also, there's 900 convicts that could just be they were just trying to escape the country, Rohingya convicts. They brought them back to Sitwe as well. They say the men, which is about 600, I believe, they will train them to fight, but basically they're all going to be used as human shields as well.
If I remember correctly, there were several thousand of Rohingyas released under the general annual amnesty about a month or two ago. And one would assume that, you know, great, I'm out of jail. I'll go home now. But when they got out, the military was waiting for them. And I've been hearing these stories about how they were all basically shipped over to Sitwe. And while no one has really said it before you just did, that the assumption was they were to be used as human shields.
And also they'll get a few weeks training and given a weapon and be told to fight.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Exactly. Yeah. They'll be useless at fighting, but they're going to be in the front line and be used as human shield, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The AA, I think, certainly this year, is likely to take, to be the first ERO, ethnic resistance organization, to take a whole state. They're likely to take the whole of Arakan state, and they could be potentially the de facto state head. They've already, when they're taking over, the United League of Arakan, the administrative political side, is setting up schools, clinics, you know, etc., police, courts, etc. They're already doing that.
Are they?
I think they have a good position of actually being a de facto state.
Yep.
They are liaising with other EROs, which they've had relationship with, and also with the NUG. But to what extent they will actually be autonomous and to what extent they will be linked to the rest of Myanmar, I don't know.
Basically, yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you next.
Economically, to be independent, they have the borders, they have the oil and gas, so they could actually do that if they want to go that route.
How Islamic could Rakhine become under a political umbrella? And also, I've got in mind the National Unity Government, the NUG, the political party that was formed by the ousted government. But they would like to see their curriculum instituted in the school program. So I've got their own federal agenda, but the AA would appear as going to run their own course. And that's why I'm asking over the Rakhine, the Rohingyas, Islamic influence over there. How strong will that be?
But how strong will the NUG influence be, you mean?
Well, actually, how strong would you anticipate the NUG to be? And also, I am curious about Islam and what's happening in Rakhine State from that perspective.
Yeah, that's interesting. The NUG will have limited say. The AA will coordinate and work with NUG as it seems fit. But they're not great fans of NUG because, as you rightfully said, Luke, the NUG was formed out of the National League for Democracy, NLD, the Aung San Suu Kyi party, which actually tried to destroy the Arakan army.
Right.
So they're not great fans of theirs, but because of expediency and real politics, they'll work with them as necessary. But there's no great love lost there at all. I think as for the Muslims, for the Rohingya there, It's mixed there. I'm hearing pretty positive things from the centre of Arakan, and Rohingya are become policemen, they join the local administration, they have no problems there. Well, I'm hearing about problems, and sometimes, you know, war crimes, unverified as yet, unfortunately, in the north, among Dao Butadong, there, where you have predominantly Rohingya, when in the centre you have predominantly Rohingya. And also that's where you have the ethnic armed groups, terrorists. I would call them terrorists. They're basically gangsters, and they've shown themselves to be that. The RSO, the ASA, the ARA, and there's another group of which name I've forgotten. The four are supposed to be grouped together. mm-hmm. which is very unlikely because they usually fight each other, the territory and the opportunity to extort more money from people. But you've got them fighting as well. And they're not wearing a uniform all the time and running around, so it's very difficult for the AA to actually fight them and find them. So sometimes I think AA has been pretty heavy-handed and actually has gone over the line in chasing, trying to stop them. But you've got that ongoing problem in the north. So guerrilla tactics by ARSA, RSO and ARA especially.
Right.
So you've got those problems there. I think the AA realizes they're not stupid, that they have to get some legitimacy, even if it's not official, from the international community. They have to make sure that their image is not too bad. They have to talk to China and India, which they are doing quietly now, for their economic interests besides India's Caledon Highway and the Belt and Road Initiative from China. So they've got all of this, but they have if they play it right, they have the potential of actually being very successful.
Right.
Also, you've got Guterres, Antonio Guterres,
mm-hmm.
the head of the UN. He's going to Bangladesh next month, and he'll be talking to the interim leader, Yunus. And one thing he's going to be talking about, of course, Yunus is going to be talking about repatriation, because that's what Bangladesh always talks about.
Mm-hmm.
But also they're going to be talking about cross-border aid and cross-border trade. This will make an enormous difference. Because in August, UNDP report said that up to 2 million people will be starving from March to June this year.
Right.
And I've got pictures of dying babies, and I'm trying to support in any way I can Rohingya who are trying to get food to villages and things like that where people are just drinking rice water. So you've got a dire situation there. If that can be facilitated, cross-border aid from Bangladesh, humanitarian aid, plus a trade from Bangladesh, this could make a big difference. So Guterres's visit would be very important.
So we might actually be seeing the early stages of a sovereign state emerging out of the crisis in Myanmar.
That is a possibility. Also, you've got the UN. UN is hosting an international conference on the Rohingya crisis, which will take place later this year. This is being facilitated by Malaysia and Finland. So that is, of course, being pushed by Bangladesh, and they'll be talking about repatriation. That is something that AA's going to have to consider, and they're going to have to do it all in stages, obviously.
Okay. And further east, Mandalay. It's a bit of a forgotten soul at the moment, but the anti-junta forces, one would assume, that staying put and laying siege to the old capital.
Well, you've got the Mandalay People's Defence Force,
mm-hmm.
which are very well thought of by locals from Mandalay. I was talking to an ex-staff member of mine in Mandalay who's still living there recently, and they're very well thought of. So basically with Mandalay, just generally in the country, is the typical guerrilla tactics of taking smaller places, cutting off supply routes. And that is what's going to keep on continuing, cutting off supply routes. They're not going to go charging in and attack Mandalay just like that. They're going to make sure that all the groundwork's done, all the supply routes are cut, and the smaller towns around and the smaller battalions around are taken care of before they actually do that.
Yes.
So I don't think we can expect that to happen any time in the next couple of weeks, for example. Could be later this year, but not for a while.
Softly, softly moving ahead. And what's your take of the junta at the moment? They seem to be under fire from all directions. They're struggling to convince the Chinese they're in charge. The Thais are breathing down their necks over the scam compounds, as in a lot of other governments from around the region and the planet. What's your take on where they sit right now?
Basically, we've got a wounded lion, haven't we?
Mm.
They're using more and more airstrikes. They're using paragliders now to attack and drop bombs.
Yep.
Which gives an indication that maybe they're running a bit short of fuel, or the aircraft take too much maintenance and have got some damage or wear and tear, etc.
Yep.
So they're using that. But also using what they call aerosol bombs as well, which are very, very nasty bombs, which they have two devices. One goes off initially to allow a lot of vaporized fuel to go into the atmosphere, and the second goes off and ignites it. And it sucks out oxygen so people can suffocate as well as a big fireball. Indiscriminately, it's a terror tactic against civilians. They haven't got much except air power.
Yeah, well, you're talking about the aerosol bombs. They sound damn familiar to napalm, which had a similar cause and effect in terms of sucking the oxygen out and from underneath the few feet between the ground and where the air ignites.
Well, I think it's quite effective, as it was in Vietnam, because people in tunnels or in bunkers, it sucks the air out from there as well and can suffocate them.
Yeah, that's the point,
When normal bombs, they might be reasonably safe.
Right. What you said about the paragliders was interesting. It was mentioned to me a few months ago that there were people in there training the military with paragliders, and I was like, "Are you serious? Are they that desperate?" I mean, all of a sudden, it looks like, you know, I don't mean to sound flippant, but the sight of those paragliders coming over from Gaza on October 7th, if what they did wasn't so horrible, it would just look farcical. But it's becoming a real weapon of war.
Exactly. They can fire small machine guns from there, plus normal rifles, and also just drop, literally just drop, and it's like First World War style, just drop bombs. And they're dropping on villages. They're not very accurate, but that's not the intention.
Yeah,
the intention is to cause panic.
Terrorize. Terror. Yeah, you're quite right. So when we were looking at 2025, late last year, I think we were forecasting that Myanmar will radically shape up this year, kind of too many issues coming to a head. Is that still the case, do you think?
I think so. I think there's so many, it's very hard to predict because there's so many criteria. Yep. But there's some very positive things that are happening. If you look for just one example is the Chin. Mm-hmm. The Chin are quite divided. You know, I've been there years ago, and it's just up and down mountains constantly. They don't even speak the same language throughout Spain because they've been so isolated from each other. It's typical for mountains or community.
Yeah.
And the north and the south have had conflict. But just very, very recently, the rival factions have united and they formed the Chin National Council. So they've agreed to do that. This will oversee the administration and defense across the state.
Right.
Basically combining the Chin National Front, which was set up in 1988, the older boys, and then you've got the Chin Brotherhood Coalition, which was set up in 2021, and you had the generation conflict, and one was wanting to fight more, the other was more talking to the military, can we make peace? But they've actually joined together, and hopefully that will stay united as the Chin National Council, which is excellent. And then you've got the Kareni, Interim Executive Council of the Kareni. They're a great example. There's been reports done on them. Great example of setting up administration, schools, universities. They've got it all set up. They've got it all set up and they control 90% of their territory. You've got this bottom up governance development and democracy. And it's bottom up. So you can have NUG at the top that might want to actually control things. But there's resistance against them, especially because of the conflict over Aung San Suu Kyi's arrest warrant.
Yep.
And a big disagreement there on that. But the ethnic organizations don't really want the risk of being under some sort of Bama overall umbrella control.
Yep.
So it's coming from the bottom up.
Yep.
So NUG has to step very, very carefully so they don't become an irrelevance.
It's interesting. We're starting to see the body politic emerging out of the ashes of war.
Yes. And as soon as they take an area, the ethnic armed organizations set up administrations, schools, the CDM doctors get back in work. They try and repair hospitals. They try and get it back as fast as possible to some sort of normal functioning governance system.
Right.
Which is excellent, which is really positive.
Okay, Paul, what's your plan for the imminent future?
Well, one thing, can I just quote someone?
Sure.
A good friend of mine.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know him, I know, you probably know him personally. Chris Gunnis.
Okay.
He's a famous BBC correspondent and was famous because of the 1988. What he said was this: the arc of history bends in the direction of justice. There is no doubt in my mind that the people of Myanmar will live in dignity. They will live in freedom. They will live free from fear. It's really only a matter of time before we get there.
That's lovely. Paul Greening, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry we couldn't talk for another 2 hours, Luke. Nice to talk to you anyway.
We'll catch up again. We'll catch up again soon, Paul. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Luke.
Okay, cheers.
Bye then. Bye-bye.